The AFEM Industry Insider is brought to you by This Is Distorted, the world's biggest producer and syndicator of electronic music programs and podcasts. For more information, go to thisisdistorted.com or at This Is Distorted on socials. On air, on demand, on brand. This is Distorted.
This is the Industry Insider from the Association for Electronic Music.
The AFEM Industry Insider.
Welcome to the Association for Electronic Music's podcast, Industry Insider. I'm Rosaline Yoon, a membership manager at AFEM. We're a not-for-profit and democratically run global trade organization for electronic music. We've got over 290 members in over 41 countries. This includes labels, lawyers, managers, emerging tech, talent, and more. I'd like to thank all the team at This Is Distorted for making this podcast possible today on this very exciting topic about releasing music in 2025. Guiding us through this discussion is Connie Chow, Marketing Strategy Director of Dance and Electronic at Fuga and an Executive Board Member of AFEM. And offering their unique perspectives on this topic, Aoife Lavery, a Senior Public Relations Manager at Infectious PR, Moody Jones, a General Manager at Empire Dance and President at Dirty Bird, also an Executive Board Member at AFEM, Chris Goss, co-founder and CEO of Hospital Records, and last but not least, Benjamin Belaga, CEO and founder of Yoyaku. So with that, I'm delighted to hand over to Connie.
Thanks, Rosalind. As mentioned, my name is Connie. I'm calling in today from Amsterdam. My predominant role at Fuga is the Marketing Strategy Director, and in that role, I guide my labels in what is the best release strategies, what they can be doing better, how they can work with their artists for better fan acquisitions, and all the hot words that everyone's throwing around these days. I think working in dance electronic music is a blessing and a curse. It is so fast. The life cycles move so quickly. I think if you listen to last year's podcast and compare it to this year, our answers might be completely different. And if we listen to it again in a year from now, the answers are even more warped. So I'm super keen to get into this conversation with you. I think a lot of these conversations are pretty philosophical with what music is in today's age, how it's being consumed. So with that, I think we can kick on in. I would love to hear from all of you what release formats is working. What has changed in the last year to this year? And how are you even approaching your release strategies? Are you going more singles-based, more albums? Do you even look at compilations anymore? What's happening in your world?
I'm happy to go first just to break the ice, I guess. Hi, guys. I'm Moody. So from our end, I run two labels. One is Dirty Bird and one is Empire Dance. On the Dirty Bird side, we've always had kind of a sense of community. We're celebrating our 20-year anniversary this year. So the fan base is very diligent and very loyal. So compilations is something we still look at. You know, we have over 400 artists that have put out music. So there's like a large roster of people to put out a compilation. Also, given it's a 20-year anniversary, compilations kind of make sense with a release strategy. In terms of singles versus albums and that the question you had earlier, for a classic label like Dirty Bird, and I think a lot of the dance labels out there, singles is still the way to go, specifically because that economy hasn't changed so much and where dance artists like to put out, you know, try out kind of every label. It's like going to a different club every weekend. You don't want to go to the same club over and over. So you'll shop your song around to all the different labels and like eventually do one or two songs. And then in return, those labels, if they're in the dance scene, usually they throw a lot of parties. And so you putting out a record with them is also you being part of the roster of artists that's considered when they're doing these events. And so, you know, it adds more shows. Those shows in turn add the ability to get content, and it's kind of like a cycle with the release strategy. So from our end, it's definitely how we're not really looking at albums on a Dirty Bird side. The Empire Dance side, which is kind of the newer model for music, we still sign. We don't do any single deals. All our deals are based on a more long-term commitment. where in the streaming community or in the streaming economy, if you're saying someone's a priority for you or someone is, you know, this is what we're focused on, there's no way that makes sense when you only have one song coming out. So in that economy, it has to be a much longer commitment where we're building something together. It's a relationship, it's a partnership. And so on the Empire side, we're not doing anything less than 8 releases with an artist.
I hear that. I mean, we're soon approaching our 30th anniversary, which is why I'm the only person here with silver hair.
I have silver hair too. I just, it's dyed.
Likewise.
You know, we've always, I think, philosophically wanted to have long relationships with artists. And so our background, you know, going back to mid-90s, you know, we were just always signing artists exclusively on 3 or 4 album deals. And if we were lucky, we would renew those deals. Everyone here fully understands that the last 5 years, let alone even like the last 12 months, have seen such rapid change. I think that we simply have to be more flexible than ever, because every artist and every artist's manager or team invariably has a different set of demands. I think increasingly, certainly in the world of drum and bass, which is not only very fast music, but extremely fast paced as a community, it's highly demanding, you know, particularly if you are on our side as label, publisher, you know, rights owners, trying to sort of navigate what particularly, you know, young and actually established artists are now expecting, which is invariably a lot of music coming out very frequently and often maybe with not so much of a focus on which particular brand an artist works with. And I'll be honest, I find that challenging, you know. Mm-hmm. Not just because it's at odds with the way that our company has evolved and the discography that we've built, but realistically, myself and the team that I work with here, you know, we want to get to know people. We want to know what their story is, because I believe that deep down, that's what we're good at, is telling artists' stories. You can't do that overnight. You can't do that in a week. And when we all look at the kind of madness of how much music is released every 24 hours. It's extremely challenging to find ourselves, any of us, rising above all of that noise to kind of say, hey, I have something quite special here that I'd like to talk to you about, but I'd like more than sort of, you know, 5 minutes of your attention. So we have to be tremendously flexible. We try as best we can to understand what an artist is looking for and how we can find a deal that might work for them. But deep down, I want to work with someone, you know, for more than a couple of tracks, and I'd like to work with them really for more than a couple of years, because I know that we need a minimum of 3 to 5 years to really deliver something meaningful and impactful.
Benjamin, what is it like in your world?
So it's a bit different, because we're in Paris. Yuyaku is we have a record label. We have a physical distribution where we distribute around 500 record labels, but physically, and we also have a record store. And so we have, you know, we have our ecosystem. We're more into the vinyl world, and we kind of understand our niche, and we're like, you know, confronted with customers because they come to our shop. So yeah, we have another kind of relationship with artists, because they send us demos. We would do a one-shot release with an EP. It won't be like a kind of a follow-up, but we honestly see the world changing, like a lot of outputs, a lot of releases, and we kind of made another move, is that we kind of realized that our strength was really in this vinyl format, where we were going to sell more copies, like the first pressings are 300, but we could go to 500, 1,000 or 2,000 copies. And we kind of decided to remove our content from all the digital platforms, because we saw that our strength was in this physical format, where we distribute to a network of physical stores all around the world. So this was a bit of an approach where where we know that this physical format, we control it, we know, we understand it more than the streaming platforms that are niche, I would say, because electronic music is I would say very wide. You know, there's subgenres, there's house, deep house, dub techno, deep techno, and the culture of, I would say, of vinyl would be really exploring those subgenres. So yeah, we see also the world changing really fast. Trends, records we were selling a lot last year, we sell them less this year. So it's we see how the crowd changes, how we also have to be fast understanding, but also keeping to do what we like in terms of A&R. So, you know, it's trying to find a balance of doing something sustainable, but also doing something in terms of music we also want to defend and want to push.
Yeah. Do you ever find yourself in a hard situation because the act of discovery without algorithm is slower?
I wouldn't say because we have our own tools, you know, and this is also like we kind of control, even if we were only in the physical world, we have an online store that's really where we have a lot of traffic per month, and it's really modern. Like we have our own API, we track data, we see in some territories where we're also strong. So I would say that we have our own ways of doing it. We don't depend on the algorithm so much, but we have our own way to extract data of customers buying this kind of subgenres or this kind of artists. So yeah, it's we have like a dev team on this, but it's not as strong as Fuga or Spotify or big online digital stores.
Yeah, at a different point in time, I'd love to know more information about your fans that you see. Because that's the goal, the active fan versus a passive fan. But Afi, I would love to hear from you in your opinion about release frequencies, because you're working across multiple labels and you're also, I think, working with artists directly. How have you seen release frequencies change over the past few years?
So I started working back with Infectious back in September last year, and we have like a lot of the artists and stuff that have been brought on recently. We've been looking, kind of mirroring what Chris was saying about trying to get those longer term artist development and album projects and so on. Like we do some singles here and there, but I feel at the moment with the landscape with press and media that we're seeing the best results whenever we have longer to plan, and digging into like stories and narratives and building momentum and pushing relationships over those longer periods of time, that's where we're seeing the best results. And sometimes that means refining what particular goals an artist has and who we're working with as a label or genre or time of year and so on. So the goal is to try and work with people for as long as possible. And that's been doing really great at the moment. That's where we're seeing the best results.
And Moody, for you, when you guys are planning out your release schedule, how do you plan your schedule so that you can support touring and making sure artists have new music on tour, and then at the same time avoiding DSP fatigue?
That's a good question. So in terms of planning releases, most of the time we don't really get involved with the touring. So most of the artists we work with are kind of experienced and have an idea of like if you're an artist, you know what you're doing and why you're releasing a song at a certain point. I don't think it's us that dictates when the song comes out. I also feel that, you know, directly challenges their creative control. So most of the time we don't get involved in when a song should come out. I will, however, give them some guidance. Like if I know that we have more than one song of a similar background or a similar sound or whatever, I'll be like, hey, just so you know, there might be another song that's similar. If that doesn't matter to you, then that's fine. But we don't really make any changes. The only times that would make sense is if there's something currently happening in like the stage of in a stance of the culture that makes sense, like visa season kicking off, or if it's like Arab Heritage Month or Asian, you know, if it's something like that, then I might make a suggestion. But we don't really get involved with anything to cause any fatigue, I guess, on a DSP side. I think the important thing for us is, it sounds very silly, but just making sure the artist really loves the record they're putting out. A lot of times, I think the real fatigue coming is the state of music consumption today shifting from artists putting out music to making it feel like artists posting content. Like today it feels like this whole release radar and weekly releases and, you know, monthly listeners on Spotify and things like that. These are all things that are kind of enforcing artists to upload music regularly. So in a sense, it went from, you know, having full creative control to now I kind of feel like I have to put out music, even though I'm busy or even if I feel like my project is complete. You know, a lot of artists kind of want to retire from that project, which is the artist's name. But if you don't put out music, your listeners just drop, your algorithm ranking drops. And so eventually it's like a slow death. You're slowly crossfading out. You know what I mean? So that's where I think the actual fatigue is coming. And it sucks because it's the artist that feels that fatigue more than the label does.
Yeah, I think one of the, you know, it's interesting listening to what everyone's saying, but reflecting on your point, Moody, and then what Benjamin's saying about the vinyl format, you know, we were a label where every single release was on vinyl. So from 96 through until I think maybe 2013, 2014, like everything was on vinyl. And in my world, it was like one track aside because that was the impact of the music and the fact that it was being played out by DJs and it needed to be cut super loud to cut through various sound systems. But one of the benefits about, I guess, releasing music on vinyl was, you know, that stuff is expensive. It takes a long time for perfecting the actual process. You know, we use one particular cutting house in Devon because they are the best people to cut drum and bass music in the UK. And, you know, that's just one aspect of how long it takes for that process. But as a result, the artist and the label has to be so convinced by the quality of that piece of music. You don't just put content on vinyl. You put something that, you know, you really love and cherish. And there's a certain sort of sense about, right, I am really, really committed to this release and to this song, right? Or this song or this EP, let alone this album. And so just thinking about what Moody was saying, you know, we are, I think all of us are to an extent sort of like suffering from this expectation of we all need stuff in the marketplace rather than let's remember that as people working in the music business, let alone, you know, whether we are artists or we're supporting artists making music and releasing music, the end game is meant to be delivering something special as a piece of music. And I think too that there is a danger that in these last few years, the industry has kind of lost sight of that.
And to put what Benjamin and Chris were both saying, because you're seeing, you know, both ends of the spectrum, and the most important thing is, you know, if you're marketing to everyone, eventually you're reaching no one. And, you know, Benjamin is able to own a pocket and build from there outwards. And so is Chris, you know what I mean? So I think it's because of so much noise, the less is more context is actually coming back to life. It's like a pendulum. And now the less things you focus on and just building a small niche community and then growing from there is the way to move forward.
Yeah, so from a press perspective as well, like because there is just such a dilution of music being put out there that like to cut through that noise with press, you have to have that background to it and that is like more substance than it just being that piece of content, you know. News, if sending out a press release isn't the same as it was 5 years ago and that you would get news across the board, you know, you kind of have to have a few headlines in there to make it really cut through. And I think that's why, like, especially working like with people a bit more longer term and so on, as I was saying earlier, you can really develop that like training within artists as well. And making them see the importance of having their artistry and their music rather than the fluidity of socials and so on as well. Both are important, of course, but I think it's like, it's beneficial for artists long term and it's going to help like build their presence within that side of things too. Gives it something more to hold on to.
I think that's also the jealousy with artists versus content creators. You know, a lot of artists spent decades to just build a community or a room that they owned. And then you have content creators that started building a community and then decided to become artists. But the rate of how quick they built that community and how much faster they were able to acquire fans is a little unfair. And that's what causes the jealousy or the resentment towards one another.
For sure. It's also, I think it's super important with artists who are coming into a space where they typically online wouldn't seem like they belong in that space, that they're getting super popular or something like that. And having the benefit of press alongside of this is to validate their art history and allow them to prove themselves whenever social people who like to pick on social media as their success, the basis of their success, whenever these younger artists and so on are properly credible and deserve a space to shout about that.
One other aspect here, which has become a huge factor in the last couple of years, is just how much expectation and pressure there is on artists to be extremely skilled within the world of social media, because we are certainly seeing that there is such a need for artists individually to promote on every level and every aspect their new release, and to do that for more than 24, 36 hours. Now, on the one hand, you have to then look at an artist's schedule and what are they doing? Are they releasing across multiple labels every 6 to 8 weeks? Let alone, is that particular artist comfortable within the realm of social media, which, let's be honest, especially now, it's essentially face to camera. Now, I don't think I've ever done anything face to camera, but that's because I'm super old, but some of the most brilliant artists are not comfortable doing that kind of thing. And that does not mean that their music is any less valuable. It's just a kind of a format and a process. I find young and much older artists equally not that comfortable with the kind of format, and then trying to understand, do I need a team? Do I need a content creator? Of course, this is also why record labels like Hospital or Dirty Bird exist. But even then, we can't be the artist ourselves. So part of what my team here are continually doing is trying to constantly come up with multiple strategies that not only suit the moment, suit the time of year, suit the track, but categorically support the artist with some integrity and authority, but particularly challenging when maybe that artist is, let's say, a little more shy or a bit more comfortable just within a studio setting than necessarily making a video or walking down the street doing all manner of things that we are all aware of that are often now part of the landscape. So that is something that I think a lot of us on all the levels that we occupy as promoters, editors, distributors, record labels are facing day to day.
Yeah, I would never want to be an artist in today's age, I for sure. could not handle the pressure of having to be on social media. And I think what's quite frustrating sometimes is the streaming platforms value 90% of all of their efforts towards the artist profile and not the label profile. And they've taken away a lot of tools for labels actually over the past few years. So I kind of want to dive into maybe some platforms, because you did mention, Chris, that there are just some artists that aren't comfortable being in front of the camera, in which the label platforms and properties have to do a lot more of the heavy lifting. And Benjamin, this is also a question for you. What other platforms exist? How do you organize your fans and how can you speak to them directly?
I guess often a platform that comes up first is Bandcamp, which I think is really, really valuable, but is at the same time is kind of also almost its entire own ecosystem. A lot of us are very familiar with the journey of Bandcamp and how it kind of got set up. But for what it's worth, within the world of drum and bass, it doesn't necessarily work particularly well for us. I think historically it's been super strong for independent artists and also, for vinyl artists, for vinyl labels. but we don't, you know, we don't manage to get a lot of kind of like great activity from it ourselves. I think it's not necessarily also like just sort of platform based. Some of it can be format based, some of it can be marketing based and, you know, media and content based. And also what, you know, what day of the week do you release on? You know, where do you go for your exclusives? Who are you partnering with for kind of editorial? And it's almost, frankly, it's kind of mind-blowing these days about quite how any label or artist decides to try and navigate a particular path for a particular song or record based on just the genre, the community, the time of year, the place that is being targeted. Are you really aiming at a particular playlist? Are you specifically building it from the ground up with your own community through, you know, through records or cassettes or USB sticks or flexi discs? You know, it's well, yeah. And I mean, you know what, people are doing it. Like, you know, I think so many of us are trying to, we're spending a lot of our time thinking, what can we bring back? What hasn't been done this month? And what is it like, let's do a mini disc release, you know, or let's do it exclusively on that, or I don't know. But I think it's so far beyond sort of platform. In some ways it's good because it's like coming down to like a continuous stream of ingenuity and original ideas. Conversations like this, where people are like, what are you doing? what's the best new idea you heard this week? Maybe we should try that.
Yeah. Benjamin, how are you speaking to your fan base? Are you email-based? Are you website-based?
So we actually are really, really active on Instagram and YouTube. So it's the way we announce the releases we have. We use those platforms to either announce releases of our own labels or those we distribute. And we kind of see a good reach of interaction. Like, you know, we're curious. Like, we see the world is changing really fast. People are consuming content on Instagram or TikTok, and the 15 first seconds, they decide if they are going to consume it. So we also have how to adapt and to get the message really fast in the first seconds, so we, you know, hook the attention. So we're aware of this, and we're also aware of our audience. So we have this post on Instagram where it's kind of straight to the point. We're not on TikTok, even if we were curious to look what's out there, because it's not especially a tool we know how to use, and our audience isn't there. But we're also really active on YouTube, where we have like in-store sessions where artists play records in the store. It could be like underground artists who are not known, but like more famous artists. Like, we had like Nina Kravitz, who also played a record set. It's not yet online, but we're doing the editing. So I would say we're in the scene of the electronic music, but we have this focus because we know this format. We had some in-store session that got a really good reach. You know, there's one that's almost 2 million views from a Japanese artist called Tomoki Tamura, who's not at all known, but he made like a wicked set on vinyl with style. And so audience out there that we didn't specifically know came to our audience, to our platforms, and we kind of like are discovering also new audiences that have interest in what we do. So this is a bit how we work out, and we kind of work out on having a conversion on our website. So these tools like Instagram or YouTube, we generally put our link of the website. We use like bots, like ManyChat, where people comment on Instagram, where we send our link. So yeah, we use social media. We kind of try to hook them. I think like Bandcamp in our scene is really used for artists. We also push direct to customer strength from the artist or the labels to reach their audience.
Yeah. And Moody, stateside, because European laws are a bit stricter with text message marketing and things like that, how are you seeing SMS marketing being used stateside or platforms like Lalo for fan communication?
It's probably the most popular platform right now. Everyone is like owning their distribution network and communication with their fan base through platforms like Lalo or Community and things like that. The price has also changed a lot over the last few years. I think prior to that, it didn't make sense to the artist to be spending that much. But nowadays, it's been the tool that we use the most, both as a label and as an artist. So Empire, Dirty Bird, we have our own Lalo channels. And then the artists themselves will have their own Lalo channels. And if you're doing events, it's also been super helpful because we're able to text people in a specific region about upcoming events, and you can measure the conversions in real time. So I can send that text message and spend $1,000, but then I make $100,000 in 24 hours. So the cost is justifiable. But it is difficult when we're scaling to other regions, because obviously we're a global label, not just a label in the US. And so it kind of hinders the growth of an artist on that side. Like, it's not an issue with the artist that he can't find fans in Europe, for example. It's just easier for us. So it might start to psychologically, you know, mess with their heads, where they feel their music isn't suited for a certain region. It's just we were able to grow it in one region versus the other.
And so, yeah, we've already established that release timelines and formats have changed quite a bit. I would love to know, from a territory perspective, if you think global campaigns dominate, or do local campaigns still have relevance, and are they effective?
So I generally work internationally. I feel like it really depends on the artist. It depends on the genre of music that we're working in. Like, at the moment, I'm working between hip hop to dance music, like dance pop to hard techno, also releasing an album like that's trip hop psych rock. So it really depends. And some artists are based in Germany, some artists are based in New York, some are based in London. So it depends on where the music is doing best. It depends on where the artist is touring and so on. So everything that I do is try to be really bespoke to that particular artist.
Is your default start global now instead of localized?
Yeah, so of course I would. It depends on whenever we take on the campaign, if there are other PRs in other territories and so on, you know. But we are working internationally, and I find, like, as I said, at the moment we're working with a lot of either labels long-term or artists long-term, and it just helps with being part of that entire story and having, yeah, a perspective on all of that, but also more than happy to work with other PRs who may be more specific in particular regions as well. Yeah, we offer strength in all areas and are happy to make things work for that particular artist or client. So yeah, I guess that doesn't, the answer is it's relative. And we're seeing result. It's, yeah, being relative and being strategic about what is in front of us.
Yeah. I would love to hear from all of you the effort that you're putting into pre-release now, because I think even 3-4 years ago, that pre-release strategy kind of completely disappeared. And then with the rise of UGC and things having moments on social media before a release is even released, that pre-release UGC is now almost default. So how much of your, what is your timeline for pre-release? When do you announce it? Is that something that you suggest to your artists? What do they feel comfortable doing? And how much of your marketing effort goes to before the release date?
I think it's, again, fairly bespoke to the artist and the release. You know, let's say with some of the music we release, I guess some of our music is maybe a bit more club orientated. Some is when we're working with vocal tracks, and perhaps it is more sort of playlist and radio orientated. Then, you know, that can be a longer kind of pre-release strategy. So there's quite a variety. Also, that said, we kind of need to be kind of quite responsive, because, you know, there's such an expectation, I think, particularly like the drum and bass crowd is generally relatively young. You know, it's quite diverse. You know, we're lucky that, you know, in terms of our fan base is a very sort of broad age range that hopefully reflects the kind of three decades that we've been working. But often it does feel these days as though, like, now, you know, when people start talking about a track or they've heard a track, they want access to it immediately, right? Which is somewhat at odds with the kind of history of my music in terms of drum and bass music, because, you know, we were built on dub plate culture, when, you know, the music that was being played in the clubs would be available maybe in a year and a half, because that was kind of the whole, almost like the whole kind of essence of the magic of the music. It was built on dubs that were being played by DJs. You had to go to a certain club to hear the music. That was the only way you could hear it. Now, as soon as, like, someone, you know, hears something on their phone, they're like, well, okay, so I can obviously stream that, right? And invariably you can. And thanks to TikTok, you know, you also, to an extent, you kind of have, it feels like that platform to an extent kind of validated the idea that you only really need to listen to 30 or 60 seconds of a track because that's music, which is kind of weird. But like, I guess to an extent with like with the way that short form content has like dominated the cultural landscape in the last sort of 3 to 4 years, people's consumption rate is so rapid that there's kind of like, there's almost like a feeling that like, okay, fine, I've consumed that, so I can move on. So, you know, we have to adopt a very, very broad range of different strategies to suit the particular track or artist and also what that artist is doing. You know, we may be in the middle of a 4-single campaign. We may be working towards an album project. We generally steer clear of one-off singles because in the current climate, that doesn't work. So, you know, it tends to kind of, I guess, be based on what is the sort of seasonal, quarterly, 6-month, 9-month strategy for that artist at play. And to an extent, I guess that will then dictate how much activity is going on pre-release. To an extent, you know, we need to work harder at the post-release strategy, because let's be honest, most of us realize that, you know, the days of like the sort of like the big Friday ship out are long gone. You know, you're talking about making a track available, and then what are you doing to support that, to hopefully ensure that it gets the coverage at all the multiple playlists at the leading DSPs to then drive the traffic and the figures that labels and artists and managers are looking for. And that doesn't often happen overnight. And we also have now, you know, we're in a world where things like discovery mode can mean that, you know, a track that we released in the late summer that's done, let's say, fairly well, gets picked up by discovery mode and like a year later is suddenly flying, and we're having to then adopt a whole second, third, fourth wave strategy to ensure that we maximize the potential of that. So, yeah, you know, there's a fairly sort of varied sort of strategy list, I think.
Moody, you said, you looked like you had something that you wanted to say. How do you guys approach pre-release?
In terms of how much we focus on pre-release strategy versus post-release strategy and so on, I think it, you know, similar to what Chris said, it really is, bespoke based on the type of artist and the music. But today, a lot of artists, especially on the DJ side, they've been very good at doing their own market research and A&Ring their own release strategy. Some of the successful artists I've seen, like Francis or Garrix or Night Freak and so on, they'll literally post 5 songs and be like, which one of these do you want? And then the crowd, the fans will be like, I want this, I want this. And then based on that, they will come up with the release strategy and align that with their tour. And now they have the content and now they know which song they should play more. Because the one of the biggest shifts is like the deconstruction of how songs move or evolve over time. Like radio used to be the pinnacle of how you make it, and radio used to have a lot of gatekeepers, and now that's not the case. I think today the real curators are back to what it used to be, which is the DJs. And so the more DJs are playing your record, that's essentially what radio is, because now you're consuming radio on socials. When you're scrolling and you hear records, that's basically radio now. Those are the songs that you don't have a choice, but you're forced to listen to. And, you know, there's some sort of content ahead of it. And so the more artists that are playing your record, the more, you know, airtime you're getting. And so based on that, you can kind of come up with a release strategy. The more artists playing your records, that's essentially the more pre-saves, more or less. That's people that are actively waiting for a song to come out. And when it comes out, there's going to be an X amount of, you know, users that can't wait to hear it and are going to go search your name and are going to boost your algorithm and so on. But then you have artists that are, you know, they won't put out. I've seen a lot of rollouts where the artist is like, I'm only going to drop this when I get 10,000 pre-saves. But that's just, that matches their brand and their communication style and how they talk to their fans all the time. They've always done releases like that, so it makes sense. But if you're an artist who never posts on social and, like what Chris was saying, you're not very camera centric, that's not really the type of person you are, and all of a sudden you're saying that, it's just the brand to culture identity doesn't make sense, and it's going to alienate people from wanting to hear the song.
Yeah. And Benjamin, what about you in the physical world? How does pre-release work for you?
We basically have like 1 month before. I understand we're kind of in a different world because we don't speak so much about that. We don't release singles. It's generally EPs with 3-4 tracks. We kind of adapt in our niche. And I would say like I really understand that electronic music is like kind of a wide spectrum, and so we have a different way of working. We generally announce the records one month before the release date, when the cutting and the galvanics are done. So we have the test pressings, and we really know the release date is fixed. We kind of have a sober communication where generally we have artists who often they haven't been on social media or Instagram before, so they kind of adapt. And generally the record lives the first month or 2 months of the release date. Afterwards it becomes forgotten or timeless, but most of the sales are part of this period.
Yeah, speaking of rollout and release plans, Aoife, for a ideal rollout, what are the things that you need in order to have your optimum plan?
Time. Time is nice. You know, I like to plan. So yeah, it depends. Again, our single EP campaigns, minimum 6 to 8 weeks. Album, 3 month minimum. Artist development, 3 month minimum.
Can you define what you mean by artist development?
So an artist that comes and we kind of want to raise their profile within media, tell their story. And that could be, and just increase visibility across media and publications in a traditional sense, and not non-traditional too, you know, like helping with social features and so on, but looking across all their activities. So it depends on if some artists might have like, you know, a few EPs coming in different labels or their own label and touring and so on. And we would look at doing like a retainer type thing that is based across that whole spectrum of activity. Then it's different if a label comes to us, then it's a case of, you know, promoting certain records and so on. But again, everything's relative to the artist and what the goals are and what the strategy is. And, you know, I think it also depends on time of year and so on as well. Like, you know, if you have ADE coming up, then you have to allow for certain lead times, or IMS, you know, a few weeks ago. You have to, you know, maybe do some planning in advance of that because half of the industry is out at IMS or IDE and just planning around that. So, you know, for an album, I like to say 3 months for a minimum for the campaign. Allow us 4 weeks planning and or so on before, be able to get everybody's ducks in a row, get all the assets that we need, make sure that we're all aligned on what it is, what the story is, like getting that narrative, I think is just so important. And different talking points, you know, unless it's, you are the bigger name, it is, again, as we were saying before, important to establish what it is, what the concept is, deeper than just the surface, like, you know, trying to break through that and, you know, trying to really, I love interviewing the artists and finding out like what it is about them that makes them the artist, even if they don't really realize that themselves, and helping, yeah, just to be a part of that sort of structure. Then that just allows for us to expand visibility across different types of media. So, you know, different realms, like your specialist electronic, if it's in that world, but then also looking at like culture and your fashion and food, even if it's relative, sport and so on. And just, yeah, making sure that there's room to get the visibility, art pitch across a wide range of things to maximize exposure, get feedback, see what's working where, you know, if the music is even worth sitting in a certain place, you know, it's all to do with what the tastemakers are saying and so on. So
I think something else that needs to be considered when release planning is, especially these days, I'm finding that certainly a lot of our artists are wanting to collaborate. They're wanting to work with featured vocalists, sometimes two featured vocalists. As soon as your artist starts to work with someone who's not a signed part of that project, you know, certainly from a label perspective and a management perspective, you need to kind of take on board that there are other conversations at play And with all the best planning in the world, when the second vocalist that's featured on that track says, oh, by the way, I forgot, I've got a track coming out on this label the week following your single. And you're like, oh, okay, that didn't even come into play and you forgot to mention that. And that's kind of just messed up the sort of 3 months worth of planning that we've been working on. And, you know, and sometimes, you know, it's just because people forget or because actually people aren't very organized or actually there are so many other plates that are spinning in that particular world, or, you know, let alone just in a particular genre. Because there is so much music coming out and it is, and people are often changing things, and you know, you've signed something off and you've committed to a release date, and then someone else says, oh, you know what, but the label that I signed this track to, they just moved it by 6 weeks. You know, there are a lot of variables at play these days, and that can make the very best release planning just sort of fall down quite quickly, and it can be quite frustrating.
The upside to collaborations, though, is over the last year, collaborations did chart 2 to 3 times higher than releases by a single artist in the dance side. So there is an upside to collaborations, but you got to be careful and think about the actual politics of putting out a record with someone not on the same label.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I mean, you know, we've been, I think I would say currently is probably 75% of our releases are collaborations or features, you know, because I think, you know, it's of course, it's one of the positive aspects of the digital landscape, right? Because people are so much more accessible. I mean, like drum and bass historically has been really smart and online for 25 years. You know, like we were working with artists using AOL Instant Messenger. You know, we were working with artists that I thought were in North London. They turned out to be in New Zealand, or they turned out to be in Brazil, because we were just working in that kind of space. So, you know, in my world, people have been and continue to be collaborative, and absolutely, you're dead right. There are multiple positives. It's just that it can mean that collective kind of conversation is a little more layered and a little more tricky sometimes to control.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot more paperwork as well. I want to ask a spicy question, and then I've got a few little quickfire questions, and then that'll be our podcast for today. So my spicy question for you is artist independence. Can an artist release independently by themselves long-term, or is label infrastructure critical for scale?
Yes. Yes, too. I think that they can do it long-term. An artist that I'm working with independently is, he just released his first EP at the end of last year. And last month he was number one Billboard Dance 3 weeks in a row. His first EP had a lot of collaborators on it, names by artists who have like a standing in the industry and are respected and respect him, even though he's, you know, a newbie. But that came from his talent and his production prowess. And I can see that continuing to grow. I'm not saying that he won't release come to labels or anything long term, but you know, I think it's just an example of somebody who's already kind of getting there on their own and from being independent. And whether he goes to another label in the future or decides to grow that into something more of his own is yet to be seen. But I think, you know, he's definitely on his way there to proving that independence is a possibility.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, as Ufa says, of course, it's absolutely possible for artists to independently release. It can also be a very lonely place and it can be unbelievably hard. And I think it can also sort of point out why, you know, labels continue to be of value. So I think it's piecemeal, you know, like for certain creative individuals, it's the perfect route. But for others, what appears to be, because, you know, especially now, let's be honest, it is so easy to release music. I'll be honest, I don't necessarily think that's a good thing. But it is, you know, we can all just, you know, we can all put out our next single in the next 15 minutes if we feel like it. So there is just so much noise out there. I think if an artist has a compelling story, has, you know, highly impactful music, then, you know, they may well strike out on their own and smash it. But they might also find that it's actually really, really frustrating and debilitating, and can feel like an impossible task. And that, in fact, the benefit of working with a really smart and creative label team, distributor team, can be what they need to find that creative collaboration and to actually elevate what it is that they do.
Like, I definitely think it's possible. I'd like to think all the artists that are signed to us are independent. We're like a label for entrepreneurs, essentially, or, you know, but I think to scale, it's going to be tough. I've seen so many artists, you know, started, see people like John Summit or Francis Mercier or so on. They all started, and for as long as they could, they stayed independent. But then there's only so many things you can give your full attention. And I think as an artist, sometimes you're like, I really don't like doing all this other stuff that doesn't add to my creativity or isn't really part of the dance community or culture. Someone else should be taking care of that, like the back end things. And that's when a label comes in. But I think it's definitely possible for all genres for an artist to exist today and be independent. I think what being independent today's definition has changed. Someone might think just because you have a DIY distributor that doesn't make you independent either, right? But so it really depends. I think that word independent is used a lot loosely, and it sometimes people look at it as a positive thing and sometimes it's a negative thing.
Yeah, I think if I were to be an artist today, I don't want to be A/B testing my digital ads. I want someone else to be doing that.
But you want to be able to talk to someone and ask them questions and hear advice and, you know, be able to do these collaborations easier and be able to have, you know, any issues. Like if something goes wrong on one of the DSPs, they can take care of it right away and can give you advice and put you in touch with the right people and book you for parties and so on. You know what I mean? But it depends what kind of artist you want to be and if that is actually something that's essential to your story, right? Do your fans care if you're independent or it doesn't matter? Right? And that's a big part of it. Some artists have built a career off saying fuck labels. That's what their career was based on. So obviously they have to stay independent.
Yeah, it depends on who the artist is and who their peers are and so on. It's everything is like dependent on what your story is and what your situation is. And, you know, if you are an artist who your music falls into the right hands of the right label, who's able to support you, then yes, that's great. Or it might be the right management team, or it might be the right agency or whatever, you know.
But one of the artists that we recently signed, I asked them, I was like, so why do you want to join Empire? And he said, because all my friends are here. So, you know, like, it has nothing to do. It's just, he's like, yeah, that's the story. I just want to be where all my friends are at. And that's his story.
Yeah.
So,
but that's also that's a great reason.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great reason. And it's all micro markets today. And, you know, I think being able to really just find the label that excels at the market or understands your market or understands your fan base is really what matters. Otherwise, there's like a barrier of entry between you and your partners. And so being able to cross that is what's most important, is finding the right team that understands your vision, understands your sound, and isn't going to ruin something that's already working for you.
And, you know, literally going where your friends are is about community.
Correct.
Community building is where ultimately we all deliver great music, great events, great conversations. And, you know, and it may take more than, you know, 6 months. It may take sort of 3 or 5 years. But if you get it right, and where we all sort of build those essential friendships and partnerships, that's what people want to buy into. That's like fans want to buy into that, right? You know, they want to be at that party. They want to wear that T-shirt because there's something very compelling about artists and creative people coming together and wanting to do things together.
Yeah. So for my final question, it's a quick fire for all of you. You have $100, pounds, euros, wherever you live, and $10,000, pounds, euros. What are you going to spend it on? Moody, I'll start with you.
God, why to put me in the hot seat?
In relation to music releases, not in life.
All right, unpopular opinion. Okay, I'm an artist. And I'm trying to promote my next release. Is that what it is?
Mm-hmm. You have 100.
Unpopular opinion. I would go to a show where someone similar is playing, get the right pass, get the right credentials, talk to the right people. You know, if it's something that really resonates with my community, I'm going to go there and promote myself there. It's like be part of that circle that I need to be in. That $100 goes along. Literally, I'll find the, you know, a huge artist that's also there, buy them a drink for $10. I don't know, but I'd use that $100 to invest in the community I'm trying to be a part of. That's who's going to give me advice. That's who's going to give me a cosign. That's better spent into the community I want to be in than spending it on like an ad somewhere for $100 that people are not going to remember after.
Yeah. And you had 10,000?
If I had 10,000, wow. I would throw the sickest party, like as good of a party as I could for 10K. Really good show. Not in a coffee shop. Stop doing coffee shop parties. I'm scared to go get a coffee now. But do something unique. Do something special in your city. Invite all your friends. Do something crazy. Spend half of it on throwing the party, half of it on promoting that show. That's how you build a fan base. That's how we're back where the parties is what matters. You can't automate connection with an artist and a fan. Like dance music is very tribal, but you know, it's built on energy, identity, and a shared space. And the marketing has to feel like a rave, not like radio.
Yeah. Chris, you're next on my screen.
If I'm honest, I guess £100, like, you know, I would probably, from a label perspective, I would probably spend that on a whole range of different kind of digital ads, because, you know, you can get quite a bit for not that much money. And realistically, you know, like from a label perspective, because like £100 doesn't get you much, right? Especially in London, you know, you're lucky to get like, you know, lunch for two people, you know, with maybe a couple of espressos at the end of it. So realistically, yeah, I guess like, you know, we would, because we do that quite a lot. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, that's what labels are doing these days, is like utilizing sometimes modest budgets carefully, but effectively, you know, at very specific sort of digital levels. If you then get to like 10 grand, yeah, gee, I mean, like, you know, yeah, like we, because we've been throwing events for 25 years and it's always kind of tempting, although I have to say at the moment, putting on shows, particularly in this city right now, is really, really hard work. Trust me. I'd like to spend that money on, frankly, sort of making more music. I'd like to spend that money on, like, I don't know, like a writing camp, or like bringing together some really smart, creative people in a space for like a couple of days to make some music, like make some film, make some video stuff. Actually, like just do some good creative. I don't want to say, I was going to say shit. Am I allowed to swear on this podcast? I almost said the word content and I might have had to then retire, but.
You've already sworn, so you're good.
Ah, okay, cool, thank you. But like, yeah, I'd like to spend that money on like some great like studios, you know, like some really good filmmakers, and just like put creative people in a space for a day or a weekend. Because, you know, we've started to do quite a bit of that. You know, we've been getting into kind of writing camps and they can be a bit expensive. But when, if you're lucky, you just get some really, really good music and some great art from putting people, especially when they don't even know each other that well, in a room for like 6 hours. You might need to like do a bit of a barbecue to, you know, and like get a few drinks from the local supermarket. But that's the reason I do this, right? I'm basically here for, I'm here for the art and occasionally the barbecue.
Benjamin, you're next on my screen.
Yeah, so I would say for €100, I would have a social moment, like a dinner with the artists, or eventually like it would be like a train ticket or easy jet plane ticket to a city like Barcelona, where there's a special concert. So yeah, I think also it's also important to see what's happening out there, out of our city, because, you know, we spend a lot of time. The artists move more than we move, so I think it's also important for us to be able to move. And for €10,000, I would say I would honestly invest in a clip. You know, we never have those times of saying, okay, I have 10K, I'd like to make a nice, you know, a nice clip where you really think of an artistic concept, you know, and it's things we don't really do anymore today in our scene. So yeah, it would be this.
Yeah, I love that. And last but not least, Eva.
I don't want to sound like I'm copying, but I think for the $100 or €100 or whatever, I would go and meet as many people for coffee as possible. Yeah, I always find like face-to-face, you never know what you get out of it in terms of your own personal inspiration, who you might meet, who might be able to help you out, who you can help out in that moment, who might be able to help you out later, you know, this community aspect, as Chris was saying. And then for 10,000, I would also do a party or event, conceptual event, get a brand involved and a media partner involved, video that stuff and get reviewers and stuff done and make it again as community based as possible to help promote whatever artist or project that's going.
I think I learned a lot in this last question from all of you. I think it's time to move to include the human part back in our daily jobs a bit more and encourage that with our artists. But I want to thank you all for your time. This was great. I love to hear all of your different perspectives. And Rosalind, I'll hand it back to you.
Great. Thank you so much, Connie. You're a wonderful moderator. Thank you, Moody, Chris, Benjamin, Aoife, for sharing your insights. I've learned a lot as well from this conversation. For all of the listeners, please subscribe to our podcast. And if you're interested in learning more about RFM, check out our website, get in touch with us, and we can let you know about more, how to join our community. Thank you very much.
The Association for Electronic Music presents
Industry Insider.